Thank you, and may it please the court. Your honors, my name is Jason Monteleone. I represent the appellant, Gary Merchant, in this appeal. It is a correctional medicine case. The facts and circumstances led to a tragic result, the amputation above the knee of Mr. Merchant's left leg. What's really before this court, I believe, are two issues. One is whether the exhaustion of the administrative remedies requirement under the Prison Litigation Reform Act was completed by Mr. Merchant, and two, whether the district court sanction excluding plaintiff's experts, appellant's experts, was an abuse of discretion. If I may start with the Prison Litigation Reform Act issue, I will then move on to the discovery and procedural sanction imposed by the district court. Relative to the Prison Litigation Reform Act, the requirement is that the inmate provided a grievance that suffices to notify the correctional facility of the nature of the wrong. Here in Idaho, the facility is administered by the Idaho Department of Correction, which is no longer a party to this litigation, in their wisdom, have basically created a two-track system. That is, if it is a medical grievance, then the inmate is to use a health service request form, known as an HSR. If it is a non-medical grievance, then the inmate is to utilize the standard grievance procedure, which is a three-part system. That three-part system for non-health grievances is one in which the inmate has multiple opportunities to challenge it. However, with an HSR, it is not as clearly a delineated system. Now, my client, Mr. Merchant, was aware of both systems, however, and had utilized both, whether he was questioning or grieving the conditions of his confinement, or he was questioning or grieving the quality of his health care. He knew there were two systems. Relative to the facts that bring us here today, they were all health related. In turn, Mr. Merchant's use of the HSR process should have sufficed to exhaust the administrative remedies under the PLRA.
Counsel, but doesn't the Corizon argue that the HSR system is not part of the grievance process?
Judge Bumate, I believe that is Corizon's argument. But the issue is both the warden, a warden for the Idaho Department of Correction, Warden Yorty, and John Migliori, the defendant physician named in the case, recognized that it's the HSR system that is utilized for health-related grievances. So here you have Mr. Merchant, incarcerated individual, and he's trying to ferret his way through the system. And the evidence in the record before this court is both an IDOC warden and a medical director for Corizon recognized that it's the use of the HSRs that allows the inmate grievances for health conditions.
Hadn't your client used the typical grievance process for a medical issue in the past?
Right. That is correct, Judge Hunsaker. I believe that he had for a non-emergent situation. Here we had a very different situation, an emergent situation, where his leg was amputated within 12 hours of transport.
So, I mean, I understand the impact, and certainly this is a really sad case. What I'm struggling with, though, is what he actually said in those HSRs were things like, "I want this medicine."
He said that
it wasn't necessarily like, "My leg is, my leg needs serious treatment. Something's going wrong here. I need to go to the ER." That's not what he said in those requests. He said, "I want cortisone," or "I want Humira," or other things. So it's not that the HSRs that he submitted on their face necessarily indicated an emergency. So I'm struggling with that a little bit. And then also, it's a little bit disingenuous, isn't it, to say that HSRs are for medical issues and the other process is for other things. HSRs are for specific requests, in the, you know, prospective requests. I want this thing. But if I have a complaint about medical care or medical services that I'm receiving, I'm going to use the grievance process. I'm supposed to use the grievance process.
Judge Hunsker, I understand your point. To address them in reverse order, I'm not sure it's disingenuous. During discovery in this case, we have a warden and a medical director saying you use the HSRs. Secondly, to respond to your other point, is there are HSRs that are in the record, ER 623 through 632. And in those HSRs, Mr. Merchant is complaining about severe pain in his legs, swelling and edema in his legs, that his leg is still very swollen. And that is all occurring in these HSRs. That shifts the burden onto Corizon to address these issues. I mean, it is, to me, blatantly obvious this individual was not receiving appropriate medical care by the very fact he swallowed a razor blade to obtain that medical care. So I do believe, and I agree with you, Judge Hunsker, that yes, it's an unfortunate set of circumstances, but when you have the medical director as well as a warden for the IDOC agency saying that we use HSRs for medical grievances, what is an inmate to do? I mean, the inmate here, Mr. Merchant, provided the necessary notice. And therefore, appellant submits all of the exhaustion of administrative remedies requirements under the PLRA were met. Turning to...
I don't remember this from the record. Do HSRs go to administration or would they only go to medical staff?
My understanding, Your Honor, is they just go to medical staff. They go to the Corizon defendants, of which Dr. Migliori was medical director for the facility in question.
And is it also true in this record that after submitting some of these HSRs, your client refused to see medical staff?
My client 100% disputes that. I don't believe that's true, and I also don't believe that's a reasonable inference from the documents in this case. When you compare all of the medical records from the correctional facility with the HSRs, that is a hotly disputed item. Mr. Merchant's position is, I tried to get attention for my leg. When I couldn't get it, I swallowed a razor blade and was immediately transported to a local hospital away from the correctional facility. Turning to the sanction. Admittedly, I am in an unenviable position. I never like to go before a court at any level, having missed a deadline. Question, the salient inquiry here is there good cause to avoid this case dispositive sanction of striking the plaintiff's experts? Was the failure to meet the deadline for the disclosure of expert witnesses substantially justifiable? I have to imagine that this august panel of jurists is not the most excited about having to handle these type of discovery and procedural deadline issues, but this one is particularly important in that it was such a drastic remedy. It was case dispositive. So it requires starting with what is the procedural transgression committed here that required such a bazooka-like sanction? And really, when we look at the record before this court, the disclosure of experts by Mr. Merchant happened 2 days after the deadline. 3 days after that, which would be 5 days after the deadline, there was a supplementation of plaintiff's expert disclosure. And the reason for that was that Dr. Madsen's plaintiff's retained medical expert, her report on standard of care, deliberate indifference, and causation had been inadvertently omitted in the first disclosure of experts.
Well, counsel, I'm sorry, I'm going to jump in one more time, and maybe more than one more time. You don't dispute that you failed to disclose on time. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And Rule 37 says that this sanction happens if a party fails to disclose on time. It doesn't say if a party egregiously fails to disclose on time or anything like that. It just says if there's a untimely disclosure, this rule is triggered. So does it really matter how many days late? Because the rule is just, if you're late, this rule, this sanction applies.
Well, Your Honor, I do think it matters, the extent of the procedural violation, because we are always looking at the facts to rarefy and clarify what sanction is appropriate in a given situation. The cases that have come out of this circuit, and even the cases here in the District of Idaho, make it clear to me that when you're going to use a case dispositive sanction like this, they're reserved for those situations that are egregious, as you just noted, Your Honor, the ones where a litigant just doesn't show up for a deposition repeatedly, or doesn't engage in discovery at all, or, you know, situations where you have such contumacious behavior that you need that bazooka sanction. Appellant submits that we don't have that here. We have a situation that falls more in line with what the District of Idaho follows in the Mannion case, which is cited in the briefing, and there's a five-part inquiry.
Let me ask you on that, Mr. Montaloni. That's a district court protocol, but the rule itself and the Yeti by Molly case would suggest otherwise. So I think it would be, that is the legal hurdle that you need to address.
And I will address that. Thank you, Judge McKeon. When I read the rules of civil procedure 16, 26, and 37 together, what I believe the standard is whether the 2-day or 5-day delay in the filing of the expert disclosures was substantially justified, whether there was good cause. And I believe that the declaration that I have filed, what I have laid out, what I have tried to explain is it was under these circumstances. We don't have a situation here where the appellant was a non-diligent litigant. We have a situation where diligence was attempted, but as Robert Burns said, the best laid plans of mice and men. There had been an effort to have staff file it timely with the necessary attachments. As soon as it was discovered that that had not occurred, 2 days later, the filing happened. And as soon as it was discovered that that filing missed the medical expert's substantive 26B4 report, it was supplemented. So good cause and substantial justification, I believe, exist to have allowed the appellant that additional 2 to 5 days to finalize his expert witness disclosures.
Can I ask one question?
There's a question from Judge Grumete, and then after that, if you want to save your time, you may. So please proceed, Judge Grumete.
Yeah, just real quick. I think you mentioned that the expert, Dr. Dowes, I think expert testimony or opinion on causation was delivered only 5 days later. But isn't it true that it was not delivered until the rebuttal expert deadline? So that was in September. So even under your theory, major substantial portions of the expert testimony was not presented until what, like 4 or 5 months late?
Judge Buente, no, actually, the initial filing from Dr. Madsen, plaintiff's initially retained medical expert, states in her conclusion that
Madsen,
the series of facts directly led to the horrible outcome. That opinion on causation was timely disclosed for Dr. Madsen. I would reserve the last minute for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Eaton.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Dylan Eaton for appellees and defendants Corizon, Dr. Agler, and Dr. Migliori. This case involves allegations that defendants provided improper medical care at the prison to inmate plaintiff Merchant in the days leading up to his off-site hospitalization in February of 2016. Plaintiff Merchant's expert and his case in chief were properly stricken by the district court under Rule 37C1 because he failed to timely disclose experts by the court order deadline. The parties agree there was such a deadline. Plaintiff admits they violated the court order deadline for expert disclosures, but they try to downplay the expert disclosure violations as minor and that it was the sanction of striking them was not justified, but they are justified. It was proper to strike plaintiff merchants, experts, due to untimely disclosures because Rule 37C1 is clear that such a sanction is self-executing and automatic, as Judge Hansecker has already noted. Moreover, it was well within the discretion of the court, and it is a discretionary abuse standard regarding the exclusion of experts. It was well within the district court's discretion to strike the experts because, for many reasons, plaintiff standard of care expert report, the one from Dr. Madison that was untimely disclosed, was signed 2 years before the litigation was even initiated. So it could have easily been disclosed before the deadline. Plaintiff's counsel's out of
control. Also, can you go to the prejudice prong? What was the harm to Corizon by the late disclosure? Because it was only a couple of days.
Well, yeah, I would beg to differ with that. There was an initial disclosure 2 days late that was an unsigned life care plan and did not include standard of care experts. Then a week later, about 5 days later, there was a disclosure of Dr. Madsen regarding standard of care opinions. They were deficient under Rule 26 and also under Rule 702. But in any event, and there was also some disclosures related to non-retained experts. Those were deficient as well under Rule C. So this was what I call a drip, drip, drip of expert disclosures. There was a life care plan that was unsigned. Meanwhile, defendants are working with their experts because they have a deadline coming up to address those opinions by plaintiff's experts. Then initially it didn't appear there was any standard of care. Then there was a disclosure 5 days later where there may be standard of care, and it was unclear what the non-retained experts were really going to testify. Then 2 months later, there was another disclosure of non-retained experts. And then the Dr. Dow affidavit that was discussed didn't show up until after expert disclosure deadlines were over and about 4 days before dispositive motion deadlines. So to get to your point on the harm issue, the defendants were harmed because they were trying to address a moving target from plaintiff's counsel with their experts. And their experts would start an opinion and then have to revise or change course because there continued to be additional late disclosures that continue to be deficient. And I think Goodman v. Staples speaks to that. There's the timeline's different in that case, but it stands for the principle that their late disclosures are harmful to the opposing party. And it also talks about, we have it here, there were concerns in that case. The defendant's experts were developing opinions without knowing the scope of plaintiff's expert opinions in that case. So that was harmful. Additionally,
I guess that's my one problem with it. The district court didn't make those type of findings. If I recall, the district court said, I've always just find prejudice from late disclosures rather than making individualized findings for Corizon.
Well, I believe that the court did say that a delay is harmless or is harmful to defendants. He said time is of the essence, and he agreed with defendants. I think that's in SCR 627, among other things, where there was such a finding. And at the end, there was a discussion about prior meet and confer on discovery with the court clerk. And we had brought up these issues of untimeliness then. And because of that discussion, defendants had to engage in costly litigation, further litigation of deposing defendants, deposing some of their folks that were disclosed untimely. And they shouldn't have had to do that because they were untimely and ultimately stricken by the court.
What do you do with the R&R Sales case, where in a situation where the sanctions really result in the dismissal, that you need to have certain findings, particularly whether there might have been a less draconian sanction imposed?
And I believe Your Honor is talking about the five-factor test. Is that what you're referring to?
Yep.
So I'm not aware of a case that applied the five-factor test. I don't believe the Sales case did in a situation where Rule 37C1 applies, striking experts and there being analysis under that rule. And in this case, the court didn't. From what I can tell from the case law, the five-factor test would apply if the sanction is dismissal or a default. In this case, it was not a sanction of dismissal. It was a sanction of striking their experts, and then the court engaged in analysis under the motion for summary judgment that then ultimately ended up being a dismissal.
Wasn't it tantamount to a dismissal given the nature of the claim and the need for the expert testimony?
I would agree that striking their experts was key to granting the motion for summary judgment. But as I understand the analysis under the case law and under this rule, the five-factor test would apply if the actual sanction is dismissal, which it wasn't in this case. The actual sanction was striking experts. And then the court had to engage in evaluating the motion for summary judgment, and as they always would. I don't know, you know, to me it doesn't seem like there'd be much of a difference if the opposing party failed to include a document, a key document or key witness testimony in support of their response or objection to the motion for summary judgment. The court would go through that analysis under a motion for summary judgment, which is kind of its own animal, to test the sufficiency of the evidence for the case in chief. The court goes through that analysis and then would dismiss it if a key document was missing. And to my knowledge,
you're saying then really there is no dismissal sanction. There's simply an exclusion sanction that once you evaluate the evidence may lead to dismissal. And that is a distinction in your mind from a sanction that is a dismissal.
Correct, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Eaton, I want to follow up on Judge McEwen's question about R&R Sales. Maybe we agree with you that there should be a distinction between dismissal sanctions and striking evidence sanctions. But R&R Sales tells us that if a striking of evidence as a practical matter results in dismissal, then as part of the court's harmlessness analysis, it's required to consider willfulness, fault, bad faith, and also the availability of lesser sanctions under Rule 37C, which is our case. So I guess my question for you is, what in the record shows us that the district court did those additional things that R&R Sales requires?
Well, Your Honor, as far as the willfulness and bad faith and fault, the court did specifically recognize the chronic failure to disclose. It wasn't just one time. It continued to happen. There were other violations of orders in the case, too, including, you know, responding late in violation of the deadline to respond to dispositive motion as well. And that chronic failure to disclose, it is tantamount, and we provided some case law in the briefing to showing bad or willfulness or at least fault. So I wanted to make that point. And additionally, under, you know, the court didn't specifically talk about the five-factor test and go through each one, but I think if you go through the hearing in totality, those elements are in there. If the court were to go that route, obviously we don't think that would be the correct route to go. But for instance, we provided in our briefing that if a court order is violated, the first and second factors fate will cut against plaintiff. And so to look at the third factor regarding risk of prejudice, well, I just talked with Judge Gudeme about the harm to plaintiffs or to defendants in this case. And that was discussed by the district court. And the fifth factor regarding availability of other drastic, less drastic actions, there's the record shows that plaintiff's counsel didn't request any lesser sanction. They didn't try to, for instance, extend.
If you go that route, isn't that an obligation of the court, not the counsel?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not following you.
Well, I mean, in terms of the availability of a lesser sanction, isn't that something that's incumbent upon the court to consider?
It would be within their discretion, and I think that's what was exercised in this case. And I do, you know, I would emphasize again that the discretionary abuse standard is important to look at, and that is what applies here. The court did make fine, you know, they exercised reasonable judgment. The court had facts and judgment in the record supporting the decision it made. So,
counsel, can I ask a quick shift gears, unless the other judges, on the exhaustion question?
Yes.
Is there a way to grieve an emergency medical issue under Corizon's procedures?
Yes, just a technical clarification. It's the Department of Corrections grievances, not necessarily Corizon's. And I think that's somewhat important, and I make that distinction because, and I'm deviating a little bit, and I'll get back to your question, but the HSRs only go to the medical people, as discussed before. And the prison grievance process is set up, and it's clear, and it's been ruled on multiple times in the local district that it's an appropriate process. There's a concern form that's separate, and then you have to file the grievance, and then you have to appeal. And that's not only to notify the medical providers, but to notify the prison as a whole and some of the other Idaho Department of Correction officials, maybe the warden that would want to know what's going on and what the complaint is and may want to get involved. So that's a little, I digress on the HSR issue. And remind me your question, Your Honor, I apologize.
How does a prisoner appeal an emergency medical grievance? Or yes, is there a procedure for that?
I don't believe that it's directly addressed, but they can't. In this case, there are complaints about the care being provided up for two weeks up to the hospitalization. So the complaints against Dr. Migliori, for instance, if there's a complaint on the 1st and the hospitalization occurred on the 6th, they could file the concern form within that time period before they have to go to the hospital. Additionally, after they come back from the hospital, they could also lodge a grievance about some complaint they have.
But what if they're having experiencing a medical emergency? You know, his leg was fully necroted and was potentially going to die, and he wasn't getting any treatment. There's no way to get a grievance appeal done without, you know, taking those weeks long, days long process.
Well, it would be I think we have to separate grievance from requesting medical care. If he wants to request medical care, he can do that right then and there to submit an answer.
Yeah, but if that's denied, then you would grieve that.
Correct. I mean, if they're on their way to the hospital in the ambulance, they can't grieve. I would agree with that. But they could grieve up through that time, and they can grieve afterwards. So.
But you're saying there's no emergency grievance process.
I don't believe that was directly addressed in this case, and I don't recall there being one, Your Honor. I just flipping to something here, excuse me. So I understood that the plaintiff Merchant concedes that he failed to complete the grievance process. He does not contend the grievance process was effectively unavailable to him. That's my understanding. Rather, his claim is solely based on the HSR, is my understanding of their complaint, and that's what's been raised on the appeal. So, you know, that.
So you're saying he's waived any argument of the unavailability of an immediate assistance?
Yes, I don't believe the questions you're asking have been raised by plaintiff's counsel in their brief.
Okay.
I believe it's been, the focus is whether you can use an HSR to grieve. And that's a separate process. And as I explained, the grieving and addressing it is a separate process from the HSR.
Thank you.
I think I would be remiss if I failed to address some of the facts.
No, Mr. Eaton, you're over time as it is.
Fair enough. I saw 1 minute. I thought I had 1 minute. I apologize.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's a common way to read the clock. Somehow red does mean stop. But
fair enough.
Just so you know, in terms of the facts, the briefing is quite extensive on this, and so we're well versed in that. So don't worry about that. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I may quickly rebut, Your Honors. I had the opportunity during Learned Counsel's argument to find the citation of the record for the causation opinion that you had asked about, Judge Bumate, and that's at ER 87. And that causation opinion for Dr. Madsen was disclosed. I would be remiss if I didn't address what is characterized as this chronic failure to disclose. Dr. Madsen's plaintiff's retained medical expert was disclosed, her CV was supplied, her prior testimony was supplied, her fee schedule, everything was supplied 2 days late. And for the district court to have simply said, it's always prejudice, it's even minimally late, is the district court not applying its discretion. And that's why we have an abuse of discretion. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate your time and listening to argument today.
Thank you. I appreciate the argument. I appreciate also, Mr. Monteleone, your candor up front about missing the deadline. The case just argued, Merchant versus Corazon, is submitted.